Hey, this is Cedric, your host of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. And before we get into today's episode with Ed Lattimore, I want to tell you about our amazing sponsors. First up, new sponsor, CipherSafe. I hope that you have taken custody of your Bitcoin and got it off the exchange and onto a hardware wallet. Now go that extra step and secure your Bitcoin from physical disaster and a single point of failure with a Cypher wheel or the new Cypher Grid seed storage device. CypherSafe's goal is to provide important, tangible security tools for Bitcoin. CypherSafe focuses on securing your Bitcoin with beautiful, elegant, and practical devices. Designed, engineered, and manufactured all in-house. Machined from solid stainless steel, not stamped out. Waterproofed, fireproof, rustproof, foolproof. The Cypher wheel is designed to be physically locked with a padlock and comes with a tamper evidence seal, so you can be aware of any attempts to steal your seed words. To keep your sats safe, go to cyphersafe.io and use the code MATRIX to get 10% off your order. Next up, new sponsor, Citadel Cabins. Between working from home, mandates, and lockdowns, you might be thinking about adding an extra room at the house or renting a place to escape or retreat from encroaching communism. Citadel Cabins is in the custom building industry, and they are famous for small log cabins that can be shipped anywhere and easily assembled by you and a couple of friends in just a few days without any specialized skills or power tools required. As we descend deeper and deeper into clown world, the cabins are creating a way for families to escape and establish KYC-free location sovereignty, surrounded by people who care about freedom as much as we do. If you are a landowner, investor, renter, or you want to provide support via your labor or expertise, Citadel Cabins has a program that's right for you. Citadel Cabins is a Bitcoin-only company that exists to help individuals achieve shelter, rest, security, and location independence. Head over to CitadelCabins.com for more information and to fill out an application now. LedIn offers interest-bearing savings accounts and Bitcoin-backed loans with the best rates in the entire industry, enabling users to access dollars or additional Bitcoin without needing to sell your existing holdings. Listeners of the Bitcoin Matrix podcast get $50 USDC when you become a LedIn user and take out a LedIn loan using our link. To learn more, sign up at start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. The Bitcoin Conference is going to be a celebration of Bitcoin, Bitcoiners, and this amazing movement that is going to make the world a better place. And it's going down this April 6th to 9th on Miami Beach. This is already a can't-miss event with all your favorite Bitcoiners in an amazing environment to chill, party, and learn, including the Sound Money Music Festival on April 9th. All tickets are transferable and 100% refundable if you are unable to travel due to COVID restrictions. Go get your tickets now and use the code BitcoinMatrix for 10% off at b.tc/conference. And now, let's enter the Bitcoin Matrix with Ed Lattimore, where we discuss what he learned from being a professional boxer, why he retired with only one loss, controlling your emotions, dealing with fear, and how he thinks weak men are the most dangerous creatures on the planet.
What is real? How do you define real?
You can't jump into cash. Cash is trash. What do? You get out.
Ed Lattimore is a best-selling author, former professional heavyweight boxer, who retired with a 13-1-1 record, a competitive chess player, and veteran of the U.S. Army National Guard. Ed holds a BA in physics from Duquesne University. His writing focuses on self-improvement and a practical approach to Stoic philosophy. Ed Lattimore, welcome to the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. How are you?
I am fantastic, man. Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah, I'm super excited to chat. We connected on Twitter. It's crazy how social media just brings everyone together from different perspectives, and sort of even, you know, Twitter has its own genres. And, you know, I just kind of really got into, I think, your timeline and your profile is cool. And I reached out, you agreed to talk. So I'd love to just get into it. You know, there's a lot to unpack here, but, you know, you kind of talk about how you've had like sort of four lives, or you're living in your fourth life. So maybe we could kind of jump back to, you know, your first life back in Pittsburgh and, you know, sort of what you might have learned growing up and where you're from.
Okay, cool. So I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm actually here right now. I live here. Gone away, you know how it is. And I grew up as a typical stereotype. I was the child of a single mother. We lived in the projects. I spent most of my youth on and off public assistance of some form, whether it be outright public assistance, cash assistance, or food stamps. And then you also in that environment, a lot of the violence and the element that you deal with in that place. And for me, I had to really figure out how to read and deal with people so I could have a good time. I could have a good, safe life. But I didn't want to fall in with anyone around me. And that's a delicate balance, a delicate tightrope to walk, because one thing I figured out is when you're likable, your life is really a lot easier. But if you're too likable, then you're expected to kind of run with the pack. That's kind of the deal. So I think that was a really really powerful training ground for a lot of other parts of my life, and really formative in my personality. And I would never want any of my children, I would never want anyone I know, I never wish that environment on them, but I take the lessons I got from it, particularly relating to people, really relating to people. I mean, when you come from the bottom, you can relate to everyone. It's a lot. I think it's easier for someone from the bottom to ascend and learn along the way how to talk to everyone on the way up and interact and how to pick up those social cues, because we're adaptable at the end of the day than it is for somebody who was born at the top to understand and make themselves comfortable with all people all the way down to the bottom. So that relatability has formed a lot of how I relate to everything else. I'm a big believer in the power of relationships and having conversations with people. I'm a negotiator almost to the point of pacifist, but I would never describe myself as someone who's going to run away from a fight. I'll avoid it at all costs, but once it's kind of like, this is what we got to do. This is what we have to do. And fortunately, you know, being an adult, you don't live in that environment. Those aren't choices you have to make, but it influences how you even deal with nonviolent confrontation. I think one of the reasons why I've had such a good time and really kind of easy on most building a social media platform is because this is all about connections and dealing with people. So you take those ideas and they work here as well. You know, I don't jump down someone's throat if they're wrong. I won't insult people because I never forget that there's a human on the other side of that. Even if it's some stupid bot account, there's a person on the other side. They got feelings, and I never forget that. So, yeah, those are really that's really the biggest lesson, man, from that part of my life is the power of likability. And just making connections. And if you're good at that, you don't have to be a brute. You should be able to be brutal, but you don't have to be to survive. And I think a lot of people growing up who had different outcomes didn't get that same lesson.
Right. That was a lot there to unpack. And you summed it up really well as, you know, never underestimate the power of being likable and controlling your emotions. And it seemed like you really mastered that well at a young age. But how did things change maybe when you turned 14?
Well, a really cool thing happened to me that is shaped. There are these watershed moments, you know. I think, I don't know where I got that phrase from, I got to look that up. But these watershed moments where if you did not go through that, you couldn't imagine anything else happening in your life. And I think that was probably the first, maybe the second watershed moment. And that was where I went to a school across town. And I had to, you know, it was an hour bus ride there and an hour bus ride back. So for 4 years while I was in high school, 2 hours of my day minimum were eaten up, you know, getting to and from school. But this was really good because it was in a completely different socioeconomic background or socioeconomic environment. I had friends in the middle class now with like houses and two-parent households and jobs and things like that that I'd never seen. And it... the way I describe it is it socialized me, right? Because I'm still friends with some people that I knew. My sister didn't go the same route, so I hang out with her and I see things. And it's funny, just little social cues you pick up. Like I was saying earlier about how when you come from the bottom, it's a lot easier to adapt as you move up if you want to continue to move up. And that I got to see how middle America lives. And it's very different. It's not that. Yeah, well, no, it is different. And we can talk about some of those differences. But it's very different than how you live when you're living in the projects. And that is it's a big deal. It really, some of my best friends to this day, you know, I was talking on the talking to you beforehand about how I was dealing with the death of my mom recently. I mean, they all came. My friends showed up to the reception and a repast we were having, and I was like, I didn't know they were coming because I just, you know, put it out there because my sister, and I wasn't even gonna put it out there. My sister put it out there, and I just retweeted it because I know people follow me, but our profiles are very different on social media. And my friends showed up, and I was like, wow, you guys here? And these are my, and they're like, of course we're here. And these are guys I've known longer than I haven't known them. I'm 36, and I met them all when I was 14. So I met my best friends at that point in my life, and their families took me on like I was one of their own. And that is one of those things that if I don't know where I would be. Right. Because like I don't think I had what a kid needs to kind of go, I want to adapt to the street life or something like that. I don't think that was in me. But I'm fortunate I never got a chance to find out. And that's what's important. They, I just think about the times they gave me a place to stay or when they figured out that I didn't like going home, that they would just let me come over every day after school and still drive me home. Cause it was still was a far away, but my car was like 25 minutes, right? But every day they would drive me back, no problem, back to the hood at that, you know, and that wasn't, that was scary. I mean, if I was, let's put it like this. I've not spent significant time in the projects as in more than a day since I was like 18. And so now I'm like desensitized in the other direction. Like when I go back, I'm like, oh goodness, I'm looking over my shoulder. But before I come home at like 10 at night and look over my nothing, right? You know what you know. And some of those instincts are still with me, right? But I'm not using them. Why would I use them? If I worked hard to make sure I never would have to use them. But that part of my life, so important because I got to be in a different place and I got to see how things were done differently. And it completely changed me and it set me on a completely different trajectory. And I have great friends because of it.
Yeah. A lot to unpack there as well. My only real way I kind of relate there is both my parents. I grew up in middle class America, 25 miles outside of New York City. Both my parents were both career public school teachers in New York City, and I would go into school with them whenever my school was closed for whatever holiday, or they sometimes had field trips, and I would just get brought in. And so I had sort of the reverse experience where I would go into the projects from about 9 to 3 or 8 to 3 on a random day, about once a month or once every couple of months. And did a lot of learning while I was there. And the comparison and the contrasting, I could still see so much and what I've learned about just for me, what it really was about just opportunity. I saw a clear lack of opportunity, which just led to so much more other issues, but it wasn't really around anything. To me, just that was the bottom line. And I just always wanted to strive to have a lot of opportunity for my family and something of that nature. But and I saw where things could go if you lost, you know, if economically you ended up having not a lot of opportunities, and how hard it is to just then find a way out of that situation.
You know, and this is something I struggle with this sometimes, right? Because I understand, like, on the one hand, you work hard, you stay out of trouble, you do your homework, right? Play a sport or something. And you know, I can't, and I go, you guys should do this and you'll get out of this situation. On the other hand, I got to remember some of the advantages I had even being born into that environment. For starters, you know, my mom wasn't the best, but she wasn't a crackhead, you know. So things are getting taken care of really at home, which are cool. I mean, I didn't like spending time at home for a lot of other reasons. But when I think about the bare baseline minimum, I had that. And I know a lot of kids didn't. I was also, when they tested me for these programs that they had in the school, plus there was this program my mom was part of when I was born to track me from birth to age 22 was the last time they did an official test of me. And they found out when I was like four or six that my IQ was like 130-ish. That's a big advantage that gives you that puts you in. Even if you're being lazy, and I didn't realize this, right? I have an article on my site about this, where I was just bad at, I thought I was bad at math, right? And I did do terrible at math in high school, but I did terrible at math. Like, my terrible, so when I gave up, but I was struggling to make a C, because I just didn't have a foundation. I got thrown into the deep end because I was the beneficiary in many ways of positive peer pressure with those friends I had. So, and I go back and I go, oh, I'm picking this up. Now, it was a lot of work, but I was able to pick it up. I wasn't short. You know, my dad was 6'3", my mom was 5'9", right? So I come out 6'1". I still got shortchanged. My sister is 5'11", man, which is crazy to me. But so I can go play sports. And sports opened up opportunities. It opened up an opportunity in high school with football. It opened up an opportunity later in life when I decided to box, right? So these opportunities that I had, I know not everyone has those. So I struggle, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, bringing up boxing, I mean, that's kind of maybe your third life or where your third life begins, or boxing comes in maybe during your third life. But I guess, you know, at this point, you know, maybe the turning there, are you sort of like maybe dealing with more of your dark side at this point? You know, what is sort of maybe the theme here? Why are you so angry maybe at this point? And
I'm angry, man, because look, I've said this differently in different ways, but I really think one of the worst moments of a child's life is when they realized how disadvantaged they are. And you react to it a number of ways because you don't realize. Here's the thing about a disadvantage, right? And this is something my sister and she's starting to understand it a little better, right? But here's the thing about a disadvantage. You don't know you have it until you're going against people who don't have it. You think everything is all hunky-dory until you go, oh, well, now it ain't got to be this way. And so until I was 14, I was around everyone like me. Even the schools we went to, they were feeders from other projects or other low class, like real low class working families, right? It was racially mostly black, but there were some whites in there too. And then I go to this school across town. I'm like, wow, man, I got to travel an hour minimum. I got to, well, really 2 hours minimum a day to keep pace with kids whose parents pick them up. Are there a bus ride away? Or they get to go home and they ain't got to worry about getting enough food or if the neighborhood's safe. These little things add up. Or they can, you know, get opportunities to do certain programs or go to certain places, and I couldn't do it. Or if I wanted to do it, you know, I worked. I either had a job or I played football hard many times, both in high school. I did three sports at work. So that culminates and you start looking, and I was like, man, why'd you have me? That's what I started to think to my mom. I mean, I was like, you, this is so irresponsible. You can't give me a good life. And I just kept thinking about it and kept fixating on it. And I got angry because it makes you angry, you know? So one of the things that I did, I mean, my mom and I actually probably from 18 to 23-ish, not a good relationship, not talking very often, stretches months without talking. I was just mad. I was mad because I felt like she could have did better. And I took that, and then you know, I would, not only did I think she could have did better, I thought I was behind in life because of that. And factually, I was. But one of the things I say, and this is one of the things I did for myself, so I always tell people this, is that, yeah, you know, what happened to you as a kid, that's not your fault. But once you become an adult, it's your responsibility to deal with it. You know, if I had killed somebody, and this is when my drinking came in and got really crazy. I'm coping with things. I don't know I'm coping with things, right? I really don't think, I don't think anyone is on substances and they know consciously, this is what I'm doing to survive. At least not at the beginning. Certainly not at the beginning. One of the things that makes me angry, and I am trying to deal with my bad social skills. Well, okay, my social skills are great, actually. But they were great when I was drinking, you know? and I'm drinking because I feel awkward. I don't feel like people accept me, whatever. It's one of the reasons why I started fighting. I was like, man, I got to be cool. I got to do something. I got to stand out. I've got to earn people's attention and affection. You know, if you take it back to what I was saying earlier about the people who came to the service for my mom. One of the things I still struggle with to this day is thinking that people just like me for me, because I don't feel like I ever had that growing up. I feel like I had to prove myself to other people, to make friends, to be cool in the house, whatever. So, you know, that's one of the things that led me into fighting. But it's definitely one of the things that led me to drinking. So when you get a chance, whenever you push forward and try to make progress in your life, you will always, I really believe it, you will always run into whatever is holding you back actively, right? Passively, it's just sitting in the background. Well, you're not trying to be a better person. Doesn't matter what your problems are. You're not trying to do anything, right? But as I was trying to improve as a fighter, and I was trying to improve as a friend, and I was trying to just be a better person in general, I kept running into this problem with alcohol. I used to actually joke. I would say I was proud of this. I would go, you know, 95% of my personal problems are either caused under the influence or exacerbated by it. And I was proud of that. I said to myself, if only I didn't drink. Instead of going, well, maybe we should fix that. And eventually I did and got it under control. But I really think about my 20s, because that's really, you know, 21 to 28. I got sober the 28th, but like December 23rd. So we'll just call it 29 and make it even, because my birthday is in February. So 8 years really of 10 of my 20s was me running into that wall. And I'm really happy that I stayed ahead of the law of large numbers long enough to fix it without a problem. Because I tell you what, man, I think there's a lot of people in jail right now who, I'm not saying they didn't break the law. I'm not saying they didn't deserve to be there. I'm saying they're there because the coin landed on the wrong side that night. They went out drinking, and And maybe they were completely in control and thought they could drive home. And then they just happened to get pulled over. And that was it. And I know that could have been me several times and even worse. And I'm lucky. I feel so lucky. I feel guilty about it, but I feel lucky as well that I got a chance to get right before the system got me right.
Yeah, man. Yeah, definitely. That's awesome. I really want to turn to the fighting part and the boxing. And, you know, how can boxing transform, you know, everyone's life?
Oh, man. Boxing, let me tell you how it transformed my life. So first there's like the, I think it's obvious, maybe not everyone, the discipline and the lifestyle to be good at this sport. Because you can't fake anything in fighting. I think in other sports, there is a certain degree of showmanship and the ego isn't there. There's something unique. It's still a loss, but getting your ass kicked feels different, you know, especially the way it's done up on a stage in front of a bunch of people who know you locally. So I carried that pressure with me every time that I went into the ring, especially as an amateur coming up and as most of my fights were local. You have to train and you have to learn and you have to do things outside of the ring to make you good inside the ring, right? You can't just part-time box. It's not like pick up basketball or something. Like, if you do this sport because of what happens, what the consequences are if you make a mistake, the rest of your life tends to fall in order in different ways. One of the best things that would happen to me is when I knew a fight was coming up, I stopped drinking that week. And I didn't drink at all as a professional, thank goodness. Actually, that's not true. My first three fights, I drank as a pro. But the majority of my professional career, I didn't drink, so I don't have to deal with it. But as an amateur, one of the things that kept me straight was as long as I was fighting, and there are lots of guys like this too, as long as I was fighting, I was in bed, my diet was on point, I wasn't drinking. But if I was just going to the gym to just stay tuned up, I would go to the gym and time everything, go cut loose, because I know I was burning off the calories. In my head, I was invincible, you know? So it didn't matter. I couldn't get fat if I wanted to. That's all I was worried about, is it's not looking good if I took my shirt off and everything. But that is the big thing. The other thing it taught me is, and this builds on the whole relationship building thing. See, boxing at the local level where everyone starts, and then really I would say all the way up until the national level. I mean, it's a game of relationships. Boxing is still, even with technological advances today, where we can just look anyone up, they're not answering your email, not answering their your call, they're not responding to your text. They don't know you. And if they don't know you from somebody else or seeing you work and come up in the game, they're not having anything to do with you. So what's he saying, Rounders? He says when he's talking about the poker pros at the table, he goes, we're not all working together, but you never see piranhas eating each other, do you, right? That kind of thing. We're not. Obviously, a lot of us are in competition. Coaches hate other coaches and fighters got grudges. But at the end of the day, it's an honor kind of system and network. I tell people all the time, I probably have like two, maybe three good friends I made in the course of a 12-year career. But that's because of my unique personality. In terms of people, if I know you and shared the ring with you, or I know the gym you came out of, whatever, and you really put the time in and you were training, then you're somebody I could have to my home and have dinner with, right? Because I know you're going to come with respect, because you can't last if you don't have that, okay? So it teaches you how to respect and get along in an environment where everybody's not really your friend, but not your enemy either. You have to sell tickets. Oh, man. Mm. And let me tell you something about selling tickets. As an amateur, they can't outright say you got to sell tickets, right? But what they can do is go, well, cost this much for the show. And we know this guy's kind of locally popular. So we're going to put him on. If we got a certain number of slots for an amateur fight, let's say we got 10 fights we're going to put on you. There's 12 guys want to fight. This other guy sells them with tickets. Maybe we can't find an opponent for you. It happens because the fights cost money. The pro level, very explicit. Everything is about dollars. And for my first six fights, because I wasn't signed, and that's a different economy entirely, but because I wasn't signed, I had to go and sell my own tickets to cover my own purse. And I didn't get half of those tickets. I got 30% of everything I sold. Because put on the show is, for the most part, shows don't usually, I mean, they might break even. Promoters really love the game, some of them. Others are working out deals where they can make a little money or do something to eat. But it's not, the club level boxing is not something you get rich off. It's not even something you do full time, for real. I know most guys I know don't do it full time because you can't. It's not enough money. But it is it's cool. You do it for other reasons, man. You do it because you put on a fight. You do it because it's cool, man. Everybody wants to be associated with a fight. I'll tell you a story. This is when I knew if I was going to stop drinking, I was going to stop drinking. Because you start rationalizing different ways to go about being sober to yourself. And one night I went out and I said, I'm going to go out and hang out. I'm going to leave my car and everything behind, no money, because if I don't have any money, I can't drink. All right. I ran into some people and they said, yo, I seen your fight because this was back before YouTube was what it is now, but you could post videos on Facebook. And they were like, yo, I seen your fight. Yo, all your drinks on me tonight. I said, God damn it. And then I went out another night. It was this bar we used to go to after the fights. And I went to another bar one night. And all of a sudden, with my buddy just hanging out, sipping beer, just light beer. And all of a sudden, shots start coming out of nowhere. And he goes, that's Gene, man. He goes, thank you for bringing the guys to the bar, man. So he's just, whatever you want tonight on you, here's a shot, take it off. So I said, okay. And this is something that you, and this is a little different, you know, off topic from fighting, but part of the fighting. If you want to make a change, you got to leave everything behind. You can't just, that's what I tell all the guys to drink. And they come to me and, you know, we're working together. I go, you got to understand, man, you can't halfway get sober. You're going to have to cut a lot of stuff out because it's crazy. But the lessons and the transformation in boxing, the discipline and about how I go about living my life, the way I interact and relate to people, because you got to be able to sell tickets, but you can't be a kick's ass, but you don't want to be an a-hole either because you got to work with everyone else still. So it really teaches you about working with people and working with yourself. And those are two of the most important things, I think, if not the most important thing, but they're very difficult. People think they're soft skills, so they're easy. Try and get some people to work. Try and get people who aren't throwing blows at one another to work together, man. There's a lot of discipline and control because you're not really angry. That's all for sure. You can't fight effectively angry.
Mm, that's interesting. Yeah. What about confidence? How does boxing maybe teach you confidence? And how important is confidence in just everyday life?
Okay. So I don't think now I lift a lot of weights and I go, you know, I'm not exactly a gym bro, but I'm way more of a gym bro than I was when I fought, because fighting and lifting weights, even as a heavyweight, they don't really go together. And I tell all the guys that lift, they go, man, look, if you want to have some real confidence, not, you know, just looking good, but some real confidence, go train for a year. Well, win a few fights, get a hit and realize you're not made of paper. You will come away knowing something that most people have no idea about. And I simultaneously know how tough I am and how fragile a human is. So I have a respect for us, if that makes sense. Yeah. I have a respect for what a human can do and what a human can take. And that makes me like I feel so, I'm not worried if somebody comes up to me, but I am worried. So I know I got to defuse that situation real quickly, you know, because I figure, look, if they have a gun, ain't nothing I can do anyway. So I'm never really worried about that. I used to tell my, when we first started dating, used to tell my fiance, I used to tell her, you know, when we're out, if somebody comes out to us, they probably going to shoot us, because nobody in their right mind is coming up to me with anything less than a firearm. It I don't look like an easy target to begin with. And I'll be very calm. See, the other thing it does, I call it turning down the noise. After you got your bell rung and you still got to fight 5 more rounds, man, reality's kind of boring, you know? It's cool, though, because what it's done is, you feel me with the Big Five test, the Big Five personality test, and there's a metric one there, neuroticism. I'm in the 0th percentile in neuroticism, and I suspect a lot of fighters are, because you don't get to be – nervousness is a thing you just learn to make friends with. Because like I always tell guys, it's not that I'm not nervous. It's like my relationship with fear. It's not that I'm not afraid. It's just, I can't do anything about it, and what I have to do is in front of me, so why am I going to give that emotion credence? It's like, you know, it's something that I think a lot of people in general are missing, and even more so today than at any point in history. We've become so comfortable that any discomfort is very disturbing. We don't like it. As a fighter, so you take a completely different approach. It's because life in general is discomfort when you fight. There's something I didn't know, right? Now it's, you know, second on. Something I didn't know. When you watch a fight on TV, everything hurts. It's just, does that punch disrupt your central nervous system or not? That's all that. It's still really the difference maker, but they all hurt. Nothing is pleasant about getting hit by a man who is trained to hit you and then has his fist wrapped in basically plaster Paris. I mean, it ain't that, but it's very close. And then with a leather glove over this designed to transmit force rather than protect his hand. Even if you block that shot perfectly, that sucks. And it never stops sucking. It's not like a hot bath water. You know, hot bath where you can get in, you feel good. So all of that, I say, you know, if you take even an amateur fight, you build your confidence way up. And you build it up by being capable of something. That's all confidence is, man. You're capable.
Right. Well, what about, because I mean, all that's kind of wild. Like, how does boxing remind you of your own mortality and like discover the true meaning of fear?
You know, so what is fear, right? When you, I learned this a while ago, and I stick with it still. You feel afraid when you know something is coming up that you may not be adequately prepared for. And if you think about everything you've ever been afraid of, or even your irrational fears and phobias, that's where they fall. In fact, I'm pretty sure, don't quote me on this because this is not my specialty, but I think the difference between a phobia and a fear is that a phobia, that response is triggered and there should be no reason for it to be. Like to have a fear of heights. Look, there ain't nothing you can do to prepare for a fear of heights. Like you can't go learn how to levitate. You get up there, that's just, you know, part of the background. But I get that. Or like a fear of spiders. You know, there's not, you can't become immune to a spider bite. It is what it is. But back to the main idea, fear. And the relationship that you develop with fear when you face it over and over again, because I don't care what anybody tells you. You're always afraid in a fight. And really the moment you're not afraid is probably something you probably need to reconsider your time there. But because you never stop being afraid of this stuff, you just develop a different relationship with the fear. I know, for example, this is how I used to think about it. When I would be afraid, that meant I needed to train harder. And that's how I shifted my relationship. I went, oh, okay, I'm not ready enough to feel unafraid. Let me go in here and feel good. Let me go in the gym and bust this out. Is my conditioning good? Let me go do some sprints. All this, that made me feel better, right? So I stopped being afraid. And that's a great way, I think, to get I don't want to say desensitized to your fear, because whatever you went through, you probably have a good enough reason to be afraid. But the goal is not to become desensitized. The goal is to change your relationship with it, for you to go, okay, yeah, like it's just, it's a feeling. It's like getting tickled, man. Like, if you get tickled long enough, you're not going to be tickled anymore. And all of a sudden, your nerves going to be, they will be kind of dead. And you'll have a different relationship with being tickled. But you can look at that. The same thing can happen negative. Like people who are victims of sexual abuse, for example, they have a very different relationship with something that some of us would have a loving relationship, which is like maybe adults or an embrace or a hug or touch. So we can change our relationship with feelings. And that's how boxing changed my relationship with fear, and how I think everyone, that's why I think everyone should fight. I've not professionally, because that sucks. But if you can fight amateur, fight a few fights, you learn that most things in this world aren't terrifying. You learn that getting hurt is okay. We knew that as kids, right? You get a skinned knee, go home, wash it, you'll be right back out same day. You know, now people are afraid of everything, I think. And I just, fighting makes me not afraid of anything. or rather, fighting probably makes me lean. I'm probably too cavalier. There are dangerous real ones, you know, but we'll figure out what they are.
Yeah. It's the boxing career still really intrigues me. And I just read your piece, 5 Reasons Why You Quit Boxing with Only One Loss. So I'll remind everyone, I mean, you were 13-1-1.
I love that piece, man.
Yeah. And maybe we could talk about that piece, and maybe from the perspective of kind of explaining how much do boxers make, maybe we could talk a little bit about how the grind and from your maybe experience. I mean, how did you fall into, you know, picking up a fight here and there? Do boxers show up to the fights? I mean,
I need to go through an edit and throw that story in a few stories. So to set the stage for what you said just now, I know we'll dig more into that article. One of the thing that ultimately made me decide, like the straw that broke the camel's back, that made me decide to turn pro from being an amateur, is there was this kid who I was supposed to fight. He was coming up from Youngstown, PA, where I was fighting at. It's about an hour drive. For whatever reason, he didn't have his pass book, which you need to fight. And I thought he needed a ride. I didn't know it was a passport issue as well. So I drove 3 hours before my fight. This is what I say. You got to get along with these people and not be crazy. Drove to Youngstown about an hour away from where I was to pick this kid up and bring him with his book. Because I was like, man, I got people coming up to see me fight, man. We going to fight, okay? I get there. Turns out he ain't able to go because it's a book issue. So I drive back, and I was, like, angry. And I don't get angry. To the point, like, when I get angry, I physically feel it, and it bugs me for about a day. Like, I feel off. And I say, you know what? I'm going pro now. There's nothing else to do amateur. And at the very least, if this happens, maybe I can get paid for whatever. All right? Set that tone. You would think, with money on the line and everything, that would never happen again. My fourth fight that happened, I didn't go pick the guy up this time, though. I got off work because I still had a job at that point. I got off work. My phone was blown up. I had been running around because when you sell your own tickets, you got to run and sell them. You got to go when people go, oh, man, I bought you. When can you meet me? You show up and you give them to them. Because this is back before, wow, man, time flies. This is crazy. This was back before Cash App, Venmo, mm-hmm. all that, right? Or people could just give it to you and you could shoot them a QR code. Now that stuff is like standard. No one sells tickets by hand anymore. Now wasn't that long ago. But so I was doing all that and it happened again. And so just know, sometimes, man, you get to a fight, the opponent's like, it doesn't show up. And it's like, okay, you sold all these tickets. Now you got to go refund these tickets. So that's taking twice as long. But now you're losing money mm-hmm. instead of making it miserable. But in that article, I cover, because people ask me, they go, man, why'd you quit? You only had one loss, right? And no, fighters don't ask that because they know the game sucks. And the minute you got a chance, unless you like win a belt or something like that, right? And you get to the point, you know, where you're able to net like 50 to 100 grand a fight, they understand it. Because look, fighting is almost no one's first choice. Maybe like the Mexicans, but they run the game. So it's really no one's first choice. So when you get a chance to get out, because fighting is better than the other alternative for a lot of guys. For me, that wasn't the case. Now, it wasn't always the case. One of the things I talk about in that article, when I first started fighting, I didn't have nothing. As an amateur, it was my best choice. For most of my pro career, it was my best choice. And then one day, it wasn't my best choice. And it wasn't even kind of close. It was like by far. So that was that. That's one of the reasons. One of the main reasons is that I just had other options and I didn't want to give up what it takes. Because I know what it takes to be good. That's one of the things I say in the article. I know what it takes to fight it at a competitive level. At least the level the gaming commission will make me fight at based on my record of history. And that means 30 hours in the gym. That means I'm not going on any of my trips. I travel quite a lot. I love traveling. Fiance is involved in travel. So along with what we pay for, we get tons of opportunities to go places. That's a hobby. That's the thing I always wanted to do. And I can do that now. I'm not interested in giving that up. Right, I've been set up a great life where I own a great living online, and I can leave it go. The other thing, and this is a more practical consideration, I am 6'1", and now they just started this, like, I think it's called Bridgerweight. And before I explain what Bridgerweight is, you got to understand something about heavyweight boxing. There's a minimum. There is no maximum for weight class. That minimum is 201. The maximum, right? There's no maximum. So what happens is that these guys have gotten bigger and bigger over the years. And now these champions, not just the champions, but the contenders, the guys who are like in the top 10 and the guys they're bringing up, they're all like minimum 6'4". In fact, I did my research, man. The average height of the fighters now in the heavyweight division, 6'3.5". And I think he probably is missing a little because the math was crunched a little crudely, but that can, I don't think anyone would doubt that. Certainly you look at any card, these guys are all like 6'4", 6'5", 6'6". I'm 6'1". And not only am I 6'1", when I'm like training in the gym, 220 is what I weigh, right? And in that new division, it wasn't around when I fought. So, and that new division is now 201 to 225. Right. That would have been like, you want to be just great. I could have put on some weight and still been fast and strong, but it didn't exist when I fought. And now I'm 36. I'm not getting back in the ring, but I know, like, because I know what it would take to get back in the ring. Yeah. And that's a heavy price to pay, especially when you got other stuff. It's an opportunity cost problem. So there's the size. The injuries. I have no, man, I don't mind getting hurt, man, but getting injured sucks. And the difference, you know, get hurt. Yeah, stomach ache, man. Every time you get punched, you get hurt. You go run some sprinting and go hit the bag, hurt. Injured is when I got a blowout fracture and I get surgery and be out for 2 weeks. Injured is when I got a grade 2, almost grade 3 concussion. And I can't even sleep without somebody having to check on me for 2 weeks. Those things are scary. Those are the things that alter your life, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's not worth it. But that's part of the game of the game. You know, when I was in it and there was nothing else I could do, or I thought that was my path, I was more than willing to pay the price because you get something out of it. If you give yourself to it, you get something out of it. That's that whole life transformation thing. Okay. And I still believe that to this day. But I don't need it anymore. And I haven't needed it. Realistically, I haven't needed to fight. I probably, during my pro career, I probably could have stopped Well, no, I think if you want to, the timing couldn't have been better in terms of when it was time to start and stop. In fact, because of the type of person I am, I actually was terrified when I took a year off, because I took a year off after my last fight. And then because I lost September 23rd, 2016, then I had another fight in December of that year, and then I fought to a tie. And then I took the year off in 2017 to focus on finishing my degree. And I was terrified because I didn't know how I was going to earn any money, but I knew I couldn't fight anymore. I needed to like get away from fighting. And I'm really fortunate. I'm not fortunate. I mean, I worked hard and ended up being able to tutor kids. And because this is really the thing I found out, man, everybody with my skill set, and it's a really unique skill set, high level at math and physics, but a certain patience and an ability to teach, those people tend to be off doing other things. So I happen to have my coach's wife is a guidance counselor at this high school, and a fairly of that, I think they're like upper middle class, if that's a thing. And those kids, I had a great time and earned a great amount of money. I've realized this is how you learn. There's levels of certain things, right? I got my first, you know, audition, we'll call it. The mother called me. We're talking through it. They were really excited. And then I found out from my coach's wife, she called me and said, okay, yeah, so I just talked to my parents, and they're really excited about the work you're going to do with their daughter, but they're just wondering, like, why you're so cheap. And I'm like, I'm charging $35 an hour. What do you mean? Why am I so cheap? So eventually, like, I did a great job with her and then a great job with another kid. And then at that point, I ended up with so much work that I've raised my price to $50 an hour, and people were still overloading me. But it was great because I was really, one, it made me better at you know, I was in my final year of school. It made me better at all the work I had to do. And it positively affected them. It also was like baptism by fire and working for yourself. And so that was nice.
Yeah, I could see that. What really came across in the piece as well was sort of, again, around the time it takes to become a professional boxer. And you know, when I was a kid, I would always think about every sort of career path, and you'd always just run through, what is that lifestyle like? And I was never going to be a professional boxer or any sort of amateur boxer. But thinking through that, just from the perspective of the article, it's like, you know, you want to fight someone, you got to coordinate, you got to sell tickets, you got to get hooked up with the right promoter, the right coach, the randomization of if you're with the right promoter, hopefully getting on the right network or television station, for the right fight, with the right opponent, who doesn't fuck up his opportunity to fight you. And if he doesn't mess it up and he's actually prepared, the more he wants to kill you and hurt you in the ring. I mean, just all the conundrum, the patience. If you have a good fight, you want to fight again, or even a bad fight, you want to fight again, do you speed it up so that you can fight more fights and get catch up, you know, or do you slow it down, and the randomization of that. So what it makes me think a lot about, though, is, I guess, like, you are a Stoic philosopher, and what is that sort of? What is your maybe your philosophy around Stoicism, or what you're thinking is there?
So my general attraction to Stoicism is something that I observed growing up when I was, you know, in the hood and the heart of things, and high school, and even in my 20s, whatever. And it's that nothing is ever made better by losing your temper and losing control of your emotion. Like, at best, things are going to get a little worse, but they never get better. And once you accept that idea, then you work on controlling your emotions. you know, however you do it, however you go about it, whether it's making sure you prevent you prevent yourself from being in situations where you are going to be emotionally volatile, or it's you working on your response in the moment, which I think are, you know, two heads of the same snake that you need to tame if you want to, be a stoic, I guess, or have stoicism applied to your life. And but for me, it's all about making sure that my emotions stay in check. That's very appealing to me because I've seen what happens multiple times and in different ways in my home, in my neighborhood, of what happens when you lose control of your emotions. And what people, the mistake they often make is they hear stoicism and they think that means you can never be expressive. No, that means nothing like that. In fact, I mean, I would say I'm one of the more expressive, fun-loving people there are. With that said, I don't just give in, certainly not to a negative emotion, because I know, one, I'm not going to feel that way in 20 minutes maybe. And two, man, imagine this. And prisons are full of these guys, by the way. They lash out in anger and do something. The emotional state is going to pass. What they do in the physical world will not. And I've seen this play out. And it is not a thing I would ever want for myself, because eventually you're going to be sitting in a jail cell. You know, it's going to be year 10. Like, oh, man, if only I'd been cool and talked to that guy to the deck. And I wasn't expecting him to fall and his head off the cement. But that's what happened. And now I'm here. Not the life. And so there's just practical considerations for developing the ability to kind of get between the stimulus and the responses, as they say.
Yeah. And kind of around that, I mean, do you think we all have to kind of clean up our acts?
I think everybody should try to be better a little bit. You know, whatever better is, you don't have to be perfect. There ain't no, perfection, man, progress. That's all. Identify where you're weak and realize this too. I really believe this. You can only go as far as your weakness or your biggest weakness. So you can do a lot. If you have to pick between like doubling down on your strength or shoring up your weakness, if it's in the spirit of competing to improve your life, you probably, oh, here's a better way to put it. If it's in a non-objective thing, like I can't measure your relationships, okay? I can't measure your income. For non-measurables, you definitely would go much further eliminating or rather reducing a negative, you know? If you can become a little more present, if you can never turn into a drunkard in public, if you can listen better, those things, just a little bit, because one day you need those relationships, you need people. And if you can make sure they are good, you're going to be good. But all it takes is one person to remember, man, you ain't, why would I answer the phone from you? I don't care what happened. Or they're not really listening to what's going on. Because they don't feel that close to you, or, you know, you really need their help for something. They look at the phone and go, this guy is just going to complain. And they put you on, they send you the voicemail, that kind of thing. Right. And the other areas where they're measurable, yeah, you know, double down in strengths. But for the background of your life, I'll always try to do better. And I think the fastest way to try and do better, to get your act together, as you say, is to look at where your act is not together and make a small improvement. And I think the return on that is going to be asymmetrical.
Yeah, that's really good advice. What is a noble sociopath?
Man. You know, it's funny. I actually don't remember writing that, but that sounds like something I would say. So so here's the thing, man. I say that because once we talked about the stoicism, right? We talked about the emotional control and encountering and dealing with fear. What we haven't talked about is that I'm pretty sure there's also a genetic leaning on my part to that. It's not, you know, and that's why the concept is attractive. So when you naturally lean towards this, and you have circumstances that force you to lean on it to be non-reactive. One of the things I had to struggle with coming up was I had to really learn the connection part of people and the feeling part. That's not natural to me. So I had to think my way through it. And in doing so, I think I've become pretty good at it. But my natural tendency is to just look at something and feel this kind of detachment towards it. In fact, you know, you ever see there's a character, they had a great show they talk about, his name is Dexter. And Dexter was a serial killer, but he was like one of the good guys. And the thing about Dexter is he was like, he didn't have like a conscience. He was like a sociopath, but he learned to think and channel it to do good things. And so I don't think I'm like a sociopath. No, I'm not. I feel things, and that's important. I feel them. The difference between me and a sociopath, though, is they will act because they don't feel it. I feel it, and then I go, okay, I'm going to discard my feelings and make the most logical choice. And that, if I have to be careful with the people around me, and I have to explain to them why I'm doing that. Because if you just look at the outcome of certain things, or you just hear what I say, and you don't know me well enough to preface it, and I don't, you know, temper my voice the right way, these are things you learn, all right? When you're this way, then it sounds just void and like just Spock logic, to the point where it is like miserable, and I've gotten way better at that. But it's taken effort, and it's a thing I wanted to, because I'm able to think through it. So here's the thing. The conclusion I reached thinking through it is people are really important, and people connect on an emotional basis. So I'm able to think through that and go, okay, so that means I have to learn this. And it's like any other language. And you go learn it, and you feel good. And then you get the benefit of having those connections and those networks and all. But like it's why it hurts me when I hear people talk about, or I see people talk about, they don't like need people or something like that, or they're afraid to express the emotion. Like, no, man, like that's real currency with humans. Like, you go, hey, you're really important, man. Like people think I'm emotive, and the reality is I just know that being emotive is really important. I know that when I tell you, you're very important to me. When I express the importance, then it makes you feel like we have a relationship. I tell my fiance all the time, you know, the highest compliment I can pay you is that you're an asset to my life. Like, obviously I love you, you know, but I'd just fall in love with you if we kept spending time together. But you're like a real asset. Like, I like hanging out with you. Like, I can't wait to hang out with you. And it's good. So that's where that comes from. You know, I would say a less catchy, less engaging way to explain that idea of the noble sociopath, because that's a sociopath. That's got good marketing, good name, is that you're able to act in spite of your emotions and just go, okay, here, and really the ability to compartmentalize them, put them over here and just do what needs to be done.
Yeah. In terms of like doing what needs to be done, or sort of being able to do things, or kind of touching on what you're saying, like I heard you articulate something that I really found striking and I agreed with. I'm just having a hard time re-articulating it. But it's sort of along the lines of like, maybe you have like a strong man and a weak man, and the weak man is saying, I'm not going to go do that. I'm going to show restraint. And it's sort of along the lines of like, well, you're not really strong and restrained if you can't do that.
Yep. And there is, I really believe that weak men are the most dangerous creatures on the planet, man. Like, here's why. So technology is incredible. It levels everything. I mean, think about it. What's that old saying? God created man equal. What did he say? Something like that. God created man, cult made them equal. That's the quote about the gun, right? And that's what guns did, you know, because before then, man, if you couldn't toss a boulder or swing a cutlass, man, you weren't gonna be able to do anything. In fact, if you like look at nobles, man, back before, like the royals, they were big humans. They weren't little dainty people. You look at like the royal family in Russia, man. Ivan the Great is like 6'8", man. It's crazy, right? That time of year, and then the whole family's like that. But my point of bringing that up is that when you can do a thing, but you don't do it, that is a lot different than when you can't do a thing because you can't do a thing, all right? And when you get the ability to do it and you could never do it before, and there's a certain resentment you have because you couldn't do it, that breeds a lot of problems. You see a lot of this, and by my first thought, a lot of these guys that showed up around, well, not just around the Me Too movement, but the Me Too movement brought them to light. Many guys that would claim to be these paragons for women's rights, and they were really the guys that were just using that as a sneaky cover, because it takes a lot of, not necessarily strength, but what we'll call courage, really, to go and get outright rejected, to be like, hey, you look good, I'm trying to do something. And they're like, nah, not interested. Takes a strong man emotionally to be like, cool, I'm gonna lick my wounds, my pride is wounded, but I'm gonna go to the next one. Meanwhile, you get these other guys really nice, they don't want to deal with that rejection, they don't want to take that pain. So they take the other route, and they get so angry when a girl goes, oh, you're just a friend, I don't see you that way, okay? You look at it, I did a presentation on this, and I just had to watch it again because I was pulling clips from it. So it's really fresh in my mind about the kind of profiles of these guys that do these mass shootings in like schools and not just schools, but also, the guy up in Canada, what was his name, Alec Manassian, who drove the van up on the road and killed a bunch of people. These are people who have power from the technology given to them. So you see it technologically there. You see it. We'll call it sociological order. They infiltrate a movement that they don't really aligned with because they see it as a selfish way or a non-confrontational way to attain what they want. So their weakness really sets them up to be very dangerous. But when you are strong, you don't have to be sneaky. You don't have to be duplicitous. You don't have to be manipulative because you can go, and if the outcome isn't in your favor, it's okay. There's not bitterness. You feel cool, but it's like if you beat a man, but you don't have to embarrass him, all right? But, and I don't know how familiar people are with the general idea, but if you beat the crap out of somebody or you best them in an argument, you don't have to embarrass them, rub it in their face, kick them when they're down, call them stupid, all right? Because when you do that, you're making them beneath. They can deal with, or I think most humans can deal with a righteous loss, most of them, right? But when you turn it into them being less than a person somehow, you make them feel weaker and you make them feel incapable. You make them feel not on the same level. And so they lash out in a way that is disproportionate and I think gives them a way to regain power that they feel like they lost. So when you're starting, in fact, it's very hard for something to happen to me. I don't even know what would have to happen for me to feel like, oh man, my power's taken. I'm stripped out. Some of these guys, all you got to do is disagree with them in public. It just depends.
Yeah, I think that's valuable advice. And sort of along those lines, what sort of advice would you give around maybe coaching children?
Oh, you know, man, I think the cool thing about kids, man, and I don't have any myself, but just working with them and as an actual, their teacher, and then seeing them in the gym and being around younger members of my family, from what I can observe and see, not being a parent, what's cool is they have their own personality. You can't like put it on them. And what you have to do is realize that all that personality is a preferred path, but they all generally want the same thing because we're more alike than we are different. We all want kind of the same outcomes. It is how we get there. It's the process we take. That's where we differ. Once you recognize that, then you stop thinking that they don't want to be skilled and great and excellent. They just are not interested in being skilled and great and excellent at what you want them to be. But once you recognize what they want to be good at, then you can change and tweak your approach. You know, it's why when I talk to people who want to bring their kid into a gym to fight, and I say, look, bring him in, try it out, but get him in a fight as soon as possible, because that's when you're going to find out if he's got what it takes to do it. And that means being able to get hit, to control aggression. We don't all come in, we're not all equal. Some people ain't got those tools for whatever reason. Physically, that's the easy. That's really actually a very easy part. The easiest part, physical. I can tell you, go out, run some sprints, come back, hit the bag. We'll spar you a little bit. You'll be ready to go for 3 rounds as an amateur. Do you have the temperament? Are you able to master the fear? Can you control? It's just a basic little thing. Controlling your breathing so you don't get an adrenaline dump. That's the thing that makes most fighters tired when they first start, that adrenaline dump. Eventually, as you get used to the environment and being able to relax under pressure, it's not a big deal. If you have that gene that just makes you nervous all the time, it's not going to be your thing. And that's cool. And that's the other thing. Kids have to be very comfortable, I think, trying stuff out and not feeling like it's the end of the world if they don't succeed. Because they don't know it, you know it. You know that they have a lot of time, and it's ain't the end of the world. So they can't feel like it is. And if you get them, if you just work with their process and figure out what they want to learn and do, we all eventually converge on wanting the same thing. Like every human gets to like 16, and they can't stop thinking about the opposite sex. Like however they get, just how they get there, and then eventually at like 30, they're like, oh man, maybe I should leave a legacy or something like that, you know. So we all want roughly the same stuff. It's just figuring out the best way to do it. And that's what makes a really good teacher, I think, is the ability to read that and to work within that constraint, because that's what it is. They look, man, if they ain't, because if they're not interested, you can't make them interested. But if they have a little bit, or you can get through, and then you foster and grow that, that's where you have a really good shot.
Yeah. I think almost unfortunately, the old fashioned way I've heard is sort of like the 20s and 30s, having fun, starting a family, spending money, whatever it is, 40s, 50s, making money, 60s, 70s, starting to think about a legacy. I think a lot of people are really behind the ball on that. But I'm completely changing gears. I'm going to throw a few words at you, and I kind of want to hear what you think is going on in the world right now. So right. Colin Kaepernick, the NFL, Black Lives Matter, and Nike.
Okay. So, you know what's, man? Just go off the cuff, man. Maybe it makes sense. Maybe it doesn't. I think first, comparing Colin Kaepernick to Muhammad Ali is disingenuous. That bugs me because Muhammad Ali legitimately gave up his career. He didn't get endorsement deals. He went to jail. Like that's a good compete. It's very different. All right. So that has always bugged me. that does not mean he doesn't have a point, hasn't done, doesn't some good, because, and look, and this is a chain stance. So I've thought about this in Chrome, because I used to have a big problem with the idea of kneeling at the national anthem as a privileged athlete, because these guys are, so they paid a lot of money, given a lot of stature and everything like that. And then I thought about it. I said, if this individual can't do this with his resources and with his platform, what hope do we have for? And people get so caught up in the thing protested that they forget one of the things that makes this country great is that we can do that, because there's a lot of places in the world you can't do that, right? And the thing he's drawing attention to now, once again, this is probably where it deviates and it sounds kind of weird. I look at numbers. I do not let myself get drawn into feelings, because feelings mess up your perception on everything. They cause you to result where you start looking and seeing how you can fit things into your narrative. They cause confirmation bias. They cause hindsight bias. It's terrible. When you look at the numbers, and this is not a justification, this is just an explanation, and this goes to you where the real problem is, in my opinion. The police, I mean, they shouldn't kill anybody unless people they need to kill. But they kill more whites than blacks. And whenever you bring that up, people go, well, of course they do. The population's higher. And that's not incorrect reasoning, but the conclusion that follows from it is incorrect, which is, well, then clearly, well, or rather, that's not incorrect calculation, but the reasoning and the conclusion you reach from that doesn't reflect a bias, or rather that does reflect a bias because they're not killing them an equal number, that's an equal portion, that's a sign that clearly there's something racial going on. Like, no, it's a sign, and this is what I've always said, it's a sign that the police department is woefully underfunded and undertrained. And I know this because I've helped people try and get into the police academy. Trust me, they're not taking four-year college graduates, you know, for special forces training and run them through an 8-month prep. No, these are regular people. Many of them, this was the thing that they want to do, or they want to do something a lot worse, you know. And if you look at the problem that way, you see it's a bigger issue with the whole policing system. But the media, I don't think the media and the government are working in coordination to make us think this. I just think it's a great story and it sells a lot. Whenever the victim is black and the police are white, they're all over it. But the facts conveniently disappear whenever the shooter is black, or whenever the officer's black, or if it's white and another way around. And so I think that's a great piece for the media to feed into. But I also think the government is kind of like, yeah, y'all just keep looking at that race thing and don't pay attention to how little money we really put into law enforcement. So TLDR, Kaepernick's contribution is slightly overrated, but it is definitely needed to bring attention to it. And if you take your eyes off of what he is protesting and the fact that there was a big issue that he protested, that's probably more telling. Also, right, when you look at the stats, I mean, let's be real here. it's not like he was, it's not like it was Tom Brady they benched, right? And people, you know, forget that. But that's what happens. When I think about these things and I say them, I've you know, gotten used to backlash because when you're black, you're not supposed to disagree with the agenda. And then you sell it and you're cool. And I'm like, look, man, that's cool, whatever. All I'm going to do is think, because by thinking, I'm going to protect myself from being in that position to be taken advantage of. So those are my thoughts on that. I don't know if agree or disagree. That's just where I'm at.
Yeah, I mean, I took it all in. It's a very complex subject. I don't have a lot of lucid thoughts or opinions on it per se. I just, I do think that we're in a bit of a hall of mirrors just here in terms of the media and life in general here in 2022.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that a lot of these issues, whatever the issue is, are tend to be perfectly designed for fallout to get heated on both sides.
Yep.
And I think most of these issues that we get caught up in are probably not the shouldn't be prioritized as the national conversation. I'd go even further, you know, and I'd like to see even just more less national conversation and just more fractured dialogue in our community.
Let me tell you something I learned. I learned a real valuable lesson last year. I went to Las Vegas on the Strip for the first time, and I got a tour by a pro baccarat, well, a high stakes baccarat player. He walked me around a casino because I don't know that much about gambling, right? And he explained something to me. He said, look, the casino hates when you sit down and you win and you leave. They hate when you sit down and lose and leave. They just need you to sit there and just keep your money in circulation. Because Tom is on their side and the house will win. What is Denzel's quote? You hang around a barbershop long enough and eventually you're going to get a haircut. What do I mean? Why do I bring this up? They don't need you. I don't think the media cares who is right or wrong. Because all they need you to do is keep looking and stand on the platform. Facebook got out of this for... As they assign points kind of to your reaction and then show you more or less stuff based on your reaction. And anger emojis were worth 10 times as much as laughter emojis. Because if it bleeds, it leads because of something called loss aversion bias. Our brains, our negativity bias, our brains pay way more attention to negativity. So if we can get you to pay attention, eventually you want to spend some money. Like, we just need you to stay on the platform.
Yeah. And you bring up money. So is freedom found in money? You know, we see famous people and rich people. You could find them.
I think freedom has a minimum viable payment. Because I've been poor, been middle, I've been what I am now, which is not quite, well, it's not rich, but it's like 2-1%, right? I think, okay, here's a better way to look at it. It's not linear. It's this, and we're going to talk about like freedom in terms of being able to do whatever you want versus being able to survive without stress. All right, because two different kinds of freedom. That first freedom, being able to do whatever you want, absolutely. That's the more money you have, the easier it goes. Assuming lifestyle creep doesn't hit you, all right? You're good. But being able to survive, this is the problem. It's good, bad, whatever. But I think it's a problem. There's a point where it gets hard, but it's really easy beforehand. Because of the way our system is set up. Like if you earn like $20,000 a year and you got a kid, there's so many programs and things available to you that aren't going to be available to you if you earn twice as much. And so your life is harder. Like this is one of the things I didn't know growing up poor until I crossed over and started hanging out with middle class people. I didn't know that you paid health insurance, right? I just had to show up to the doctor with this little, we had a little yellow card. The Keystone like insurance for being poor, and it was cool, just showed up whenever you needed to, and it was no big deal. I didn't know that there was a such thing as like a copay and money, medicine costs money, but it only costs money if you're in the middle. Same with lunch, school lunch. If you're poor, they give you lunch tickets. Lunch is free, it lets you make a certain amount of money. Lunch ain't free anymore. Neither is what you think of as bus passes. We live more than 2 miles away, only if our parents made under a certain amount of money. So it's I think if you want to experience the world and meet people Cause that, and I'm not talking about date. I mean, like friends. Like my friends are all around the world. I want to see them. I mean, I can hop on Skype with them, but I ain't the same as kicking it, playing the game of chess. You know, some coffee in person costs money to go do these things, to see these things, to just survive. Not so much. And even if you want to live a simple life, because I really think your freedom is kind of a formula, and it's like what you desire. Minus with your ability to do it, and the closer that is to zero or negative, the better. So it'll be kind of a negative correlation. And when that's positive, you're probably not going to be too happy. Right? Like if you got a $100,000 dream life a year and you're only making 50, probably not. You're going to feel restricted, but you ain't got to feel that. That's all in your head because you make more than enough to survive.
Yeah, man, I hear you. I've enjoyed this conversation immensely, and I can't tell you how much I've appreciated it. I'll leave the floor to you for any sort of final message, and definitely let people know where they can find you and your writing and all your work.
Cool. So, man, yeah, you can find me everywhere, Ed Lattimore on the internet. I'm edlattimore.com. Ed Lattimore is my Instagram. Ed Lattimore is my Facebook. Ed Lattimore is my YouTube. Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, Ed Lattimore, right? And website, edlattimore.com. And yeah, man, final thought. The most important thing I kind of figured out, there's two things I tell people. One, the difficulty of a task is irrelevant if it's vital to your success. And the most powerful belief you can have is that given enough time, you can learn anything. You combine those two things. And also, I guess, three. People are the most important thing above all things. I really believe and know that. And it's just a fact of life. So people are the most important thing. You can learn anything given enough time, and the difficulty of a task is irrelevant if it's vital to your success.
Yeah, man. Thank you so much. This has been so dope.
And thank you for having me.
Ed Lattimore on controlling your emotions, dealing with fear, and why everyone should get in the ring at least once, right here on the Bitcoin Matrix podcast. This episode was brought to you by Citadel Cabins, CipherSafe, Ledin, and the Bitcoin 2022 conference. If you take your Bitcoin security seriously, go that extra step and secure it from physical disaster with a CipherWheel seed storage device. Go to CipherSafe.io and use the code MATRIX for 10% off your order to keep your sats safe. Citadel Cabins exists to help individuals achieve shelter, rest, security, and location independence. Head over to CitadelCabins.com to fill out an application. Ledin.io is a secure, simple, and easy-to-use platform for managing and growing your digital wealth. If you want to see what it's all about and get $50 free in USDC when you take out your first Ledin loan, head over to start.ledin.io/Bitcoin Matrix. The Bitcoin Conference, April 6th to 9th, is going to be Coachella for Bitcoiners, and I hope to see you there and chill out in South Beach with you. Make sure to use the code BITCOINMATRIX at checkout to get a 10% discount on your tickets to the conference. And thank you for listening. Stack sats, stay humble, and stay laser focused out there. This is Cedric. Peace.